more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. As the sesquicentennial anniversary of the Civil War continues, it's the perfect time for the Milwaukee Rep to stage one of the most popular productions to hit American theaters in the last few years, the post-Civil War drama called The Whipping Man. But it would be a mistake to call this merely a period piece. The story featuring a Confederate soldier returning to his abandoned and destroyed home and reuniting with two of his family's now former slaves covers themes of identity, religion, and the meaning of freedom. The Rep's production is directed by Brent Hazelton. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce caught up with him during tech rehearsal, which we're hearing some of now. Also on hand was Jody Hirsch. The Judaic Education Coordinator at the Jewish Community Center of Milwaukee was a consultant on the show. That's because the Confederate soldier at the heart of the story was Jewish. Hirsch talked more about the history of Jews in the Confederacy.
There probably at the time were about 20,000 Jews in the South, probably 150,000 Jews in the whole North America at the time. And of those 20,000, we don't have great statistics, but it's thought that maybe a quarter of them had slaves. And most of them, like the De Leon family in this play, were city Jews. They had house slaves. They didn't have plantations and huge numbers of slaves. I mean, there were exceptions, but basically it was probably a quarter of the Jews in the South had slaves.
And while, as you say, most slaves at the time either adopted or were forced to adopt the religion of whoever owned them, there's nothing in the historical record that says there were any Jewish slaves, but it's completely plausible and completely feasible. And given that, you know, the Civil War actually ended on Passover in 1865, there's something so rich about the potential contradictions in there, as Jody was saying, and just the potential sort of mind-bending revelations of how you reconcile that with Judaism.
Passover, of course, is the story of the Jews being led out to freedom. And yet you have these two slaves celebrating the Passover Seder, or I guess at this point in the play, they actually have been emancipated. Talk about some of that complexity.
Well, it's amazing to me just to think of this. Passover, there's all this language about, you know, we were slaves and now we're free, and the Lord brought us out of there with a outstretched arm and a mighty hand and so forth and so on. So it's just, what did those people think that they're having their Seder? They're talking about how we always use the language we, how we escaped into freedom from Egypt, and they're being served by black slaves. The food was cooked by slaves, probably in a Jewish home. The slaves knew all about cooking kosher, but there's a huge contradiction, and I think people just didn't really think about it. It's just the way of life in the South, and it was just the way things were.
And of course, we see that attempt to reconcile these two ideas in Caleb, who has come home to an empty house, injured from the battlefield, and he is celebrating this Passover with two former slaves of his family.
Yeah, it's Caleb's returned, and he's a little shaky in terms of his faith right now. The war has, I think, has called a little bit of that into question, just the vast scale of suffering and destruction. So he's trying to work that out for himself at the same time that Simon, the older of the former slaves, and John, the younger of the former slaves, are also trying to deal with their own newfound freedom. And the Seder for Simon and John is a very active, very affirmative, celebratory. This prophecy, this legend, this story has now come to pass for real. It's become true. So dealing with that, and I think there's a certain element of that in Caleb's receiving of the Seder as well, as he's learning how to accept their freedom as well, you know, and how to sort of see these people as people that he's only seen in one context previous to this, and the world is changing around all of these guys, and they're really struggling to deal with it. And that, for me, is one of the fascinating questions about the play. You know, we have a moment in time where the world has been fundamentally and irrevocably altered, and people have to deal with that, you know, and we see these moments throughout history, you know, whether it's Pearl Harbor or the Kennedy assassination or September 11th, you know, where the world that you go to sleep in at night is fundamentally changed from the world you woke up in the morning and forever will be, and there's no going back. So how do you move forward in that new world? You know, how do you make your peace with that and discover yourself in this new context? And all three of these characters are on that journey, and that's For me, the most interesting big picture thing about the play is just how do you adapt to an adapting world?
Jody, as you were consulting on this, what perspective did you bring to the understanding of how Jews at that time kept slaves and how, as Jews today, we think about that time in American history?
Well, I mean, part of it is the universal thing. You know, I mean, the slave owners, the slaveholders in the South were clearly on the wrong side of history. I mean, we look at it today and we think, I mean, it's not just Jews. I mean, it's how could we have done such a thing? And the play is about, well, how do they negotiate this new ground? You know, are they friends? Is there something else? Because the black slaves used to be owned by this young white guy. I mean, so I think that what I bring is partly that, you know, talking about modern sensibilities, but partly is, you know, we want this to seem authentic. We want this to seem like what would have happened in 1865 during Passover of that year. I mean, Appomattox, the surrender, Lee's surrender at Appomattox literally happened during Passover. And so there are all these issues. You know, there's a line in the traditional Seder, which they say in their Seder in the play, where we say, every year we say, this year we are slaves. Next year may we be free men. So that's an intriguing thing. You know, we say that now every single year. And so obviously it has this huge symbolic idea. But now if you think about 1863, when here you have the white Jews sitting at their table saying, this year we are slaves, may next year we be free men. And you have these black Jewish slaves serving the white people. And they also say, this year we are slaves, may next year may we be free men. But they're really slaves, literally. So it's just mind-boggling. So I think one thing that I try to bring to it is some kind of sense of authenticity. We've talked about everything, you know, what would they have done? You know, what would they have eaten? Would they have worn something on their heads? And what would that have looked like? And so I'm trying to help them do this accurately, or at least with the sense that it's really accurate.
I think it's interesting you mention what would they have used as the traditional foods of the Seder, because at that time in the South, most places were just ransacked.
Well, and the interesting thing about it is, you know, the first Seder, as we say in the play, was improvised, you know, this exodus out of Egypt, and they're using whatever they have as they go along, you know, and those found objects have now become the traditional elements. But these guys have to come up with their own found objects too. So it's sort of a wonderful reinvention of the whole Seder tradition to fit modern times, but also colored with a really wonderful traditional African-American sense of worship. So you sort of see the ceremony and see the belief system being adopted and internalized by a different group of people who then make it their own, you know, and there's something wonderfully fundamentally American about that too.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting part of the play too, this idea that these two characters, John and Simon, are taking something forced upon them by their masters, yet they're taking on the identity as Jews. And in fact, they kind of wrestle with that. I mean, at one point, I think John asks, are we slaves or are we Jews? And I think that's such a fascinating question of identity that they're all wrestling with in this show.
Right. I mean, at one point, especially Simon talks about it as a gift, you know, that this is a gift that they're Jewish. And yet it's full of these contradictions, which I think are really wonderful. And there's an element of the whole story about redemption. The Jewish tradition talks about a redemption that happened in the past. That's a redemption from Egypt. But it's linked also to a redemption in the future when the Messiah comes. And clearly, for Simon and John, they are being redeemed in the most literal sense. They are emancipated. And I think that the playwright just doesn't miss that connection.
Yeah, and the redemption notion is so important, too. I mean, it's a play about I think the big picture theme is not necessarily about the Civil War, not necessarily about Judaism, but just freedom in general and how you move ahead in your life as a truly free person. You know, it's real, genuine self-actualization, you know, and this notion that you have to continue to earn it every day and you have to continue to work for it every day, and that you're, as Jody was saying before, you know, this notion of the concept of slavery in the Seder sort of becoming a metaphor in contemporary times. What are your individual enslavements? You know, are you greedy? Are you out of shape? I mean, whatever those things are. But that the Seder itself in Judaism in general, I think, demands that you continue to try to do better, you know, and that redemption is always on the table. You know, you can always improve yourself. You can always improve the world around you. You can always look to do better in some way. And that's sort of Simon's constant refrain throughout the play, trying to get Caleb and John to let go of the past and move on and move ahead, you know, because Simon knows that now there's an opportunity to really and truly be free, and you can't do that if you're still encumbered by the things in your past. So it's really a strong ideological through line throughout the play. How do you let go of the wrongs that have been done you and move ahead? And especially when you're talking about something like enslavement, which is, it's hard to contextualize the scale of that wrong done to another human being. But how do you let that go and move past it? You know, and that goes for Caleb the enslaver as well as John and Simon the enslaved. How do you put that behind you somehow and move on? And to a large extent, I think that's still a question we deal with in America today. You know, how do we really unify ourselves, and how do we really move forward collectively?
I wonder if, as an audience member, when you're watching this play and you're feeling that tension and that discomfort as these three characters try to navigate the changing relationships between them, if it doesn't remind you of some interactions you've had with perhaps someone of another race or another class or a different ideology or belief system.
You can't not relate to it, you know, particularly given how polarized our political conversations in this country are today. But there's the sort of dueling notion of freedom in the play, the freedom from or the freedom to, and that perhaps just because you are able to do something, just because you are allowed to do something, perhaps the freer choice is actually not exercising that right, you know? And I think that's the core of the gun control debate today, you know? Simply because you can, should you? Some people would say, yes, that's my right, absolutely. And some other people would say, well, but is it wise in this day and age to really exercise that right anymore? So I think these notions of exercising individual freedom, I mean, they're at the core of the play, and that they're a core of every significant national conversation we're having today. So that uncomfortability will feel really familiar. And I would hate for people listening to this to think that they're going to get some sort of gut-wrenching, you know, emotional, ideological, political diatribe, because that's really not what the play is. I mean, it's three wonderfully, fundamentally human people wrestling with these ideas, but it's that human journey much more than the ideological one that we're exploring here.
When you were rehearsing the show and working through the play, what kinds of conversations were you having amongst yourselves with the cast, the crew, as you were dealing with some of these really raw emotions that the play can provoke?
Well, we spent the first week just sort of doing a dramaturgical week, you know, just reading through the script, talking about the themes, talking about ideas. We went up to Jody's place. He hosted us for a Seder, just actually ran us through one, so we all knew what it was, which was really valuable and a heck of a lot of fun besides. Talked a lot about the Civil War, about sort of the politics behind it, what these characters would have known, what they wouldn't have known. And the play is structured really interesting because it's a period piece, but there's a very heavy contemporary awareness of what was going on in the period. So sometimes the characters speak or operate with knowledge that history and hindsight has granted them a little bit, and not in a way, I just made it sound like that's a terrible fault and a mistake of the play, but I really think it's an advantage because it allows the play to sort of have one foot in each world in a really interesting way. So we talked a lot about the legacy of slavery, you know, and what it means to be in a country that has only not had slaves for 150 years and has had slaves for 300 or 400 years before that, you know. We're not even halfway done with that journey yet, you know, and the notion that everyone sort of expects that we should be there already, I think, is a little tidy and maybe a little false, and is preventing us from dealing with real questions that we need to deal with. So we talked about all sorts of stuff in the room, not only in the context of you know, getting everyone's viewpoint on the table as it informs their character, but also in terms of what sort of conversation we want to have with the audience, you know, what do we want them to walk away with?
I really think it was a privilege to be part of this, these conversations, because, you know, the actors are really thinking about their roles. Well, what would Simon have thought about this? Or why? We had a conversation that I was part of just the other day in which every character was talking about, well, why are they coming to the Seder? Why is it important for the character to have a Passover Seder in April of 1865? And what are they thinking about when they do that? And that was such a rich conversation. You know, I'm a teacher, so I talk a lot. So it was really hard for me not to talk a lot during that conversation, but just to listen to them, and it was fantastic.
Well, Jody Hirsch and Brent Hazelton, thank you both so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Pleasure.
Brent Hazelton directs the Milwaukee Reps production of The Whipping Man, runs through March 16th at the Stimke Studio Theater. The official opening night is this Saturday. Jody Hirsch is the Judaic Education Coordinator at the Jewish Community Center of Milwaukee and consulted on the production. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Of course, arts reporting and arts coverage is a major part of what we do each and every day, each and every week on Lake Effect. Lake Effect's very own Bonnie North is with us in the studio. You do a lot of arts coverage, and, you know, we say this a lot, but it really bears repeating. If not here, then where?
Pretty much nowhere. There's certainly a lot of wonderful reviewers in town, and there are a lot of people writing about the arts, but hearing about it, that's where we excel, and that's where we sort of have a unique place in the media pantheon, because we give artists a chance to talk for themselves. You actually hear them talking about their work, or actually maybe hearing a scene or some music that they're playing.
Right. We take you to tech rehearsal. Yep. Sometimes we have musicians that come and play in our studio, or people who do readings in our studio as well. And it's the kind of thing, you know, between that and the interviews that we do and the commentaries and essays we have, it's really only found on the radio and in this one place.
It is. And if you appreciate that, and we hope that you do. We hope that you also donate right now. We're trying to raise $950 this hour, and the way you help is by going to wuwm.com/give or call 414-227-3210. There is no donation too small, just as there's no donation too large, of course, either. What's important is that you actually make the call or you go online and you become an active member.
Whether it's $20 for the year or $20 a quarter or even $20 a month that you can afford, please do take advantage of this winter membership drive and become a member or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio, 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. We do have a team of people ready to take your phone call, and we have a team of people here in the studio who say thanks. That's Thursday's show. Tomorrow, our Project Milwaukee series on Black male incarceration in Milwaukee continues, plus a unique approach to music education underway in Shorewood. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.